From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the films of the late 60s and the 70s that changed Hollywood. We talk with Peter Biskind, author of the new book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, how the sex, drugs, and rock and roll generation saved Hollywood. Then we'll look at how today's independent movies are changing the film industry. We'll talk with James Shamus and Ted Hope, founders of Good Machine, the production company that made The Wedding Banquet, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, The Brothers McMullen, Safe, and The Ice Storm. Making Movies, coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says she's a little more hopeful about talks today in London on the Middle East peace process. Albright spoke today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She'll meet later with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. NPR's Michael Goldfarb is following the London talks.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright held 5 hours of talks this morning and into the early afternoon. That was much longer than expected. That meeting ended. Secretary of State Albright went back to her hotel. She is now meeting with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, presumably to put details of proposals that the Israelis have brought up. And then when that meeting is finished, according to Mr. Netanyahu, he expects to have another meeting with Secretary of State Albright. And there seems to be some movement. Initially, we thought that this day would end by mid-afternoon London time, but it now looks like going on for several more hours.
NPR's Michael Goldfarb. Convicted Unabomber Theodore Kaczynski will be sentenced today. A California judge is expected to give him 4 life terms in prison, plus 30 years, as part of a plea bargain. Kaczynski's victims and relatives of those he killed will also attend the hearing. Susan Mosser, whose husband was killed by a Kaczynski bomb, says she'll remind the court of the bomb's nails that pierced her husband's body and what might have happened if her children had been in the room. Kaczynski committed at least 16 Unabomb attacks between 1978 and 1995. Florida is fighting to protect its multi-billion-dollar citrus and vegetable industry from Mediterranean fruit flies. A new infestation is being fought with aerial sprayings of pesticides. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
State agriculture officials get nervous if they find 1 or 2 Mediterranean fruit flies in a given area. Lake County is just northwest of Orlando, and it's buzzing with over 1,200 of the pests, and that's prompted an emergency. Med flies aren't harmful to people, but they do lay their eggs in fruits and vegetables, which leaves the crops inedible. That's why med flies are considered one of the most destructive farm pests there are. The state of Florida sent up military-style Huey helicopters yesterday to spray pesticide over the one orange grove most infested with med flies. The chemical bug killer Malathion is mixed with a sweet liquid made from corn to get the flies' attention. The Lake County region is one of the few spots in north-central Florida still growing oranges following killer freezes in the late 1980s. Most of Florida's citrus has grown farther south, and med flies have turned up there as well in the past weeks. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
The Tony Award nominations are out, honoring the best of Broadway. The musical version of the novel Ragtime is up for 13 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 80 points at 9,227. Trading is active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, it is an enthusiastic start for Wall Street. Financial markets are taking up where they left off on Friday. NPR's Jack Spear has more.
Well, market euphoria seems to be busting out on Wall Street at the beginning of a new week. Shortly after the opening bell in New York, stocks began climbing. The Dow at one point had gained more than 100 points. As investors have decided that recent reports make it less likely the Fed will move to hike interest rates when it meets later in the month. Also, some good news for would-be home buyers today. The National Association of Realtors reported the best showing for its housing affordability index in some 2 years. Basically, that means the number of people who can afford to buy a house moved higher during the first 3 months of the year. Biggest number of the week, meanwhile, the April jobless data comes out Friday. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Computer software maker Microsoft warns that if its new computer operating system is delayed by the federal government, the whole personal computer industry will suffer. Microsoft has planned the release of its Windows 98 program next month. The company's chief financial officer has written to more than 100 stock analysts, software firms, and venture capitalists that he does not know if the government will interfere with the release date. The Justice Department's filed an antitrust lawsuit against Microsoft. The agency alleges Microsoft is trying to control the Internet browser market with its new Explorer browser, which is part of Windows 98. Two auto parts firms are planning to combine. Dana Corporation of Ohio says it'll buy Connecticut-based Eklund for about $4.2 billion. Dana says it gets two core Eklund items, brakes and engine fluid products. Each have sales of more than $1 billion annually. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, the Film Society of Lincoln Center honors Martin Scorsese at its annual gala tribute. Scorsese and his generation of filmmakers who shook up Hollywood in the 70s, directors like Coppola, De Palma, Spielberg, Altman, and Lucas, are the subject of the new book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. My guest is the author Peter Biskind, who's former executive editor of Premiere magazine and former editor-in-chief of American Film. Biskind says the two movies in the late 60s, The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde, paved the way for the films of the 70s. Here's Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway in a scene from the first part of Bonnie and Clyde shortly after they've hit the road together in a stolen car. Bonnie is trying to seduce Clyde, but he rejects her advances.
I might as well tell you right off. I ain't much of a lover boy. That don't mean nothing personal about you. I mean, I never saw no percentage in it. Ain't nothing wrong with me. I don't like boys.
Boy.
Huh? Boy, what?
Your advertising is just dandy. Folks never guess you don't have a thing to sell. You better take me home now.
Now, you wait.
Now, don't you touch me.
All right. If all you want's a stud service, you get on back to West Dallas and you stay there the rest of your life. You're worth more than that, a lot more than that, and you know it, and that's why you come along with me. You can find a lover boy on every damn corner in town. It don't make a damn to them whether you're waiting on tables or picking cotton, but it does make a damn to me.
Why?
Why? What you mean, why? Because you're different, that's why. You know, you're like me, you want different things. You got something better than being a waitress. You and me traveling together, we could cut a path clean across this state and Kansas and Missouri and Oklahoma, and everybody'd know about it. You listen to me, Miss Bonnie Parker. You listen to me. Now, how would you like to go walking in the dining room of the Dolphus Hotel in Dallas wearing a nice silk dress and have everybody waiting on you? Do you like that? Does that seem like a lot to ask? That ain't enough for you. You got a right to that.
You write in some detail about the making of Bonnie and Clyde, and you say that Robert Towne was a script doctor on the movie. He worked on the script for about 3 weeks during post-production.
Right.
What problems did Warren Beatty and director Arthur Penn think the script had?
Well, Penn just didn't really like the script. Well, Beatty loved the script, and Beatty, of course, bought the script and produced the movie, which was also unprecedented for an actor to produce a movie. Penn was apparently less enamored of the script than Beatty. One of the problems was there was a menage a trois between the Beatty character, Clyde Barrow, Bonnie, played by Faye Dunaway, and a character called C.W. Moss. Beatty and Dunaway, or Bonnie and Clyde, were romantically involved, but somehow Beatty couldn't get it together, you know, without C.W. Moss being present. So there was a suggestion there was a homosexual relationship between C.W. Moss and Clyde. Well, nobody could deal with this element in the script. Towne, Beatty, and Penn thought it was too much to ask of the audience that they accept a homosexual relationship as well as these people being bank robbers and killers.
So they were afraid they'd lose the audience and the audience wouldn't identify.
Yeah, they were afraid. I mean, it was risky asking the audience at that time to identify with bank robbers and killers. And to throw in homosexuality into that mix Penn and Towne and Beatty felt that was just too much and persuaded Benton and Newman to take it out.
So when they took out the homosexuality aspect of the screenplay, they put in impotence instead.
Yes, exactly.
The Clyde Barrow, Warren Beatty character was impotent in it.
How that arose, I have no idea. They made him sexually dysfunctional. And it does work in the script, you know, and if you give the script a kind of, you know, give the movie a sort of Freudian cast to it.
Bonnie and Clyde is one of the films that you said is opening the way for other new directors and for a new kind of movie. Most of your book is about Martin Scorsese, Coppola, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Brian De Palma. Do you think that these directors were basically welcomed into Hollywood, or do you think they had to, like, bang the door down in order to get in?
Well, they definitely had to bang the door down in order to get in. I mean, it was a mixed bag because on the one hand, Hollywood was in a severe recession. The people running Hollywood, some of them were the old moguls who started the movie industry in the late 60s. For example, Adolf Zucker, who was around 92, was still sitting on the board of Paramount. Jack Warner's was still running Warner Brothers. So these guys were so out of touch that the movies they were making were doing really badly. So by the late 60s, the industry was in a very bad recession, and when Easy Rider kind of turned everything on its head, the sense was, oh, you know, these guys, there's a huge audience out there, a culture, counterculture audience of young people. These guys know how to reach the audience. So on the one hand, they were sort of welcomed. You know, as Paul Schrader said, you know, anybody with a ponytail and a German Shepherd and a tie-dyed shirt could waltz into a studio and suggest anything. You know, the more outrageous, the better. But on the other hand, the old men who were running the studios hated these people. They were dirty. They had long hair. They walked around with bare feet. They couldn't stand to eat with them in the commissary. So it was very much a kind of approach avoidance, love-hate relationship. And some of these directors had to work very, very hard and hustle hard, you know, to get into the system.
Any themes you were able to find about how they broke in and how they got their training before getting there? I mean, I think one of the greatest film schools of the time was Roger Corman's studio. He'd hire inexperienced people to work cheap. That was one way of doing it.
Well, a lot of them went to film school, and the film schools were just really getting started in those days, and the sense of it was that you couldn't get there from here, that you went to film school, and if you were lucky, you made industrial films or maybe commercials or worked for the USIA. Another way, in some sense, a lot of the people who went to film school ended up going through Roger Corman's kind of exploitation factory. And Corman had an enormous impact because he would hire anybody, really, who was interested and showed the slightest gleam of talent. The Corman route was helped a lot of people get hands-on training. Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper worked for Corman. Corman also hired Scorsese to do Boxcar Bertha. He hired Coppola. He hired, a lot of those guys. Towne wrote for Corman. He hired a lot of them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Biskind, and his new book is called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. One of the seminal films of the early 70s is Mean Streets, which has just been re-released, although in limited edition. I'm not sure how much of the country will have the opportunity of seeing the new release of Mean Streets. But Scorsese apparently had a fair amount of trouble getting this movie made. What were the obstacles he ran into?
Well, first of all, he didn't have any money. And, the financing was raised privately. And, you know, in those days, I mean, one of the remarkable things about the decade was that the studios were making these kinds of innovative movies. It wasn't like they were marginalized and relegated to one side the way they are now, where there are particular companies who specialize in these kinds of movies. But for somebody like Scorsese, straight out of film school, he did a little editing for Warner Brothers, but he really had very little entree into the system. He raised the money privately and shot the film on a rock-bottom budget under terrible conditions. Some of them, you know, he tells stories about how half a scene would be shot in L.A. and the other half a scene would be shot in New York, and they'd be spliced together. And he had a terrible time when the film was finished getting a studio to take it on. He took it around various studios. He got more or less kicked out of Paramount. And it wasn't until he took it to Warner Brothers, some of whose executives actually grew up in the neighborhood or near the neighborhood where the film was shot, that he got the film distributed. And of course, when they did, and even when they did take the film on, it came out right around the time of The Exorcist, and Scorsese always felt that the studio did a poor job distributing it. The film never did very well when it came out, even though it got great reviews.
Yeah, even though every independent filmmaker has tried to remake it in their own image.
Right, exactly.
Scorsese desperately needed money to finish the film, and Corman offered him $150,000 toward the production, but there were strings attached. What did Corman want before he gave the money?
Yeah, Corman wanted to turn it into a black exploitation films were so-called blaxploitation films were very popular in those days, and Corman said he would give him the money if he turned the whole film black. And of course, Scorsese refused because the film was about his own personal experiences growing up in Little Italy, and it would have ruined the movie.
And the backers for the movie wanted not Harvey Keitel in the starring role, but they wanted an already star, someone who was already a star in the leading
yes.
role. Who? What names were mentioned?
Well, essentially they wanted John Voight, who was very hot, coming off Midnight Cowboy and a few other movies at that point.
Hmm. What are some of the other changes in the film industry that accompanied the new films as they came out? Changes in the studios, changes in theatrical distribution?
Well, there was a revolution in casting, which was enormously important. A whole new kind of actor came to Hollywood and routinely, people who normally would have been character actors at an earlier point became stars, as I said, like Hoffman and Pacino and De Niro. That's, Harvey Keitel. That's a very, Barbara Streisand, a very important change. And these were people who were, essentially ethnic actors, who either looked Jewish, looked Italian, or whatever. So there was and that was part and parcel of a kind of a refusal to use stars. The sense was that a star could be a debit for a movie instead of a something of value. The sense was that if you put a star in a movie, people related to him as a star, whereas there was a hunger for realism in movies, for reality, partly because the reality that surrounded people in their daily lives are becoming so intense as a result of the struggle against the Vietnam War and so forth and so on that, the riots in the streets, the plane jackings, the reality was kind of overwhelming the movies, and people wanted to see more reality in movies.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Biskind, and he's the author of the new book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the movies of the 70s. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Biskind. He's the former executive editor of Premiere Magazine and author of the new book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. In the beginning of your book, you quote Leonard Schrader, the screenwriter who's also the brother of screenwriter and director Paul Schrader. You quote Leonard Schrader as saying, "This group of people, the directors of the late 60s and early 70s, started to make really interesting films and then just took a big toboggan ride into the gutter. How did that ever happen?" Do you agree with that a lot of the really talented people who transformed Hollywood just self-destructed?
Yes, I do agree with that. I mean, I think it's one of the most interesting aspects of this whole era is how it ended, which is to say that a lot of these guys became very successful and very powerful at a very young age and essentially couldn't handle it. And, of course, you have to remember that this was the era, a big drug era. And a lot of them got very, very heavily into drugs and destroyed themselves in the process.
Who would you put in that category?
Well, a good example is Scorsese, who started doing cocaine during Taxi Driver, which was shot in 1975. I mean, Scorsese was a very bad asthmatic, and he had been taking drugs since he was a kid. He carried around an inhaler, and he took God knows what kinds of medications, all of which were prescription for his asthma. So it was no big deal. Drugs were no big deal for Scorsese, and he was an addictive personality. He got heavily into drugs. And as he said himself, he had a death wish that he was pushing himself, pushing the envelope, in some sense, trying to see if he could kill himself. He felt that he was not going to live past 30. And in the late 70s, he was at Telluride, and apparently they had to score some coke at the festival because they ran out. They scored some bad coke. And when he got back to New York, he started bleeding all over the place from all his orifices and from his, you know, skin and his nails. And went to the hospital and found that his platelet count had dropped precipitously, and was told by the doctor in the emergency room that unless you get some transfusions immediately, you're going to drop dead. And it turned out that from some drug interaction of the coke with the drugs he was already taking for his asthma, he had an adverse reaction and he nearly died. And it was that that sort of turned him around and made him realize that maybe this wasn't such a great idea.
And what movie did he come back with?
He came back with Raging Bull, and he, you know, famously said that it finally made him. Raging Bull was not a movie that he wanted to make. He couldn't relate. He was not interested in boxing. He couldn't relate to Jake LaMotta, who was an awful person, and Scorsese, and who antagonized and alienated everyone around him. And Scorsese finally, after going through this near-death experience, could finally relate to the LaMotta character and feel that LaMotta is me on the same, you know, to some degree, I'm the same kind of person. I'm alienating the people who love me.
Your book is not only about the directors of the 70s who changed Hollywood, it's also about some of the producers who came in and changed Hollywood and then kind of changed it again. You talk about the new Paramount regime of Diller, Eisenberg, and Simpson and how that transformed Hollywood filmmaking. What year are we talking about here? Place us.
Well, there was a big change in 1975 where Evans and Peter Bart, who ran Paramount Production, left. The people who ran Warner Brothers, which was a very important, influential hip studio in the early 70s, John Calley and Ted Ashley left. They came back eventually, but it was never quite the same. And also in 1975, Jaws came out, which had an enormous impact in terms of changing Hollywood for the worse, a lot of people feel. The studios suddenly realized there was a lot of money to make in movies, more money than they had never made before. So they wanted every movie to be like Jaws and Star Wars, which created the so-called blockbuster syndrome. So they weren't interested in small movies like Taxi Driver anymore, even though Taxi Driver did quite well. So it became increasingly difficult for directors to make the kinds of small movies that the studios were eager to make in the early 70s. And getting the Paramount regime came up with this notion of high concept, which was essentially a TV idea. You know, one of the things that changed was they started putting a lot more money into TV advertising. Movies had to be able to be advertised in 15 or 30 second TV spots, which meant that the plot had to be summarizable in 15 seconds or 30 seconds, which was the high concept. You had to be able to boil a movie down to three or four sentences of, you know, 20 words each. And if you couldn't do that, they weren't interested in making the movie.
Peter Biskind, you are the former executive editor of Premier Magazine, which is a movie magazine. I'm wondering what some of your frustrations were dealing in a magazine that is so dependent on celebrity journalism. I think a lot of celebrities really hate talking to the press. They're tired of telling their own life story. They don't want their personal lives investigated by the press, understandably. And so much of movie magazines are dependent on the celebrity profile. That's what is believed to, like, sell the magazine in the first place. So you have to do the celebrity profile with a celebrity who doesn't necessarily want to be profiled. They just want to sell their new movie. So what were some of your frustrations dealing with the kind of journalism that sells?
Well, you're right. It's very frustrating. There are very clear parameters about what you can say and what you can't say. And with Premier, we always used to take, and we still do, take the high road, whereas our feeling was that a celebrity's personal life was off limits. We focused on celebrities' professional lives, and unless the personal life could be shown to be relevant to the professional life, to the movie, or the way the movie was made, we left it alone. But at the same time, you're right. I mean, how many times can you do a cover story on Tom Cruise? I mean, you end up rehearsing the same material over and over again, and it's very difficult to bring a fresh perspective or get fresh material into these stories when you've already done the same person three or four, five, six times. I mean, that was one of the reasons I was interested in writing this book, because people were much less guarded. The events of the 70s were 20 or 30 years ago. a lot of these people are no longer players, and they don't have much to lose. Plus, these were big egos, very charismatic, eccentric people who were much less guarded than they are now today. I mean, celebrities today are very, very careful and very fearful about bad publicity. But Coppola, talking about the 70s and talking about the people he dealt with in the 70s, was much less guarded than, say, Coppola talking about a movie he's making today.
Were you able to get the directors you write about in your book to talk about themselves and to talk about the problems that they had with drugs and their own ego and the studios?
Yes, they were actually remarkably frank about it. As I said, for one thing, it makes a big difference if the book is not about a particular director. If you're writing about Scorsese, he gets very nervous. But if you're writing a book with about a whole decade, they know that the whole book is not about them, and that makes them a lot more relaxed. Secondly, as I said, it was a while ago. I mean, it's clear that a director like Spielberg, who's working consistently and has a very high profile, was much less eager to talk and much less frank than a director like Friedkin or Bogdanovich, whose career is not going well. As I said, they have much less to lose. At the same time, some of these feuds, which started in the 70s, you know, have very deep roots, and people still feel very strongly about them. They're as if they happened yesterday. I was quite surprised, for example, with the vehemence that somebody like David Geffen still hates Robert Towne. Robert Towne still hates David Geffen. Robert Towne is not speaking to Jack Nicholson or Warren Beatty or Robert Evans. Schrader still feels competitive with Scorsese and is willing to sort of bad-mouth him in a very, you know, surprising way. Or Spielberg and Schrader are not close. Or Coppola and Lucas, the competitiveness the two of them felt still manifests itself in what they have to say about each other. So I was quite surprised that some of these things that go back 20 or 30 years still bring fire to the mouths of the people who speak about them.
Well, Peter Biskind, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Fine. Thank you very much for asking me.
Peter Biskind is the author of Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in $350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. All the animals come out at night. Buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets. I go all over.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from Netcom, Internet access and web hosting solutions for small businesses, 1-888-NETCOM-3. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, independent movies and how they're changing the movie industry. We talk with James Shamus and Ted Hope, founders of Good Machine, the production company that made The Wedding Banquet, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, The Brothers McMullen, Safe, and The Ice Storm. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The success of some independent films like Pulp Fiction and The Full Monty is changing Hollywood. My guests are two of the producers in the middle of this shifting landscape. James Shamus and Ted Hope are the co-founders of Good Machine, the production company whose films include The Brothers McMullen, Safe, and Walking and Talking. Hope and Shamus describe their company as director-driven. The director they're most associated with is Ang Lee. They're currently working on his new film, and they produced his films The Wedding Banquet, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, and The Ice Storm. Here's a clip from The Wedding Banquet. The main character, a gay Chinese-American, is trying to hide his homosexuality from his parents, who still live abroad. They've sent him an application from a matchmaker, and he's trying to fill it out. Here he is with his partner.
But look at yourself. Your parents send you a form in the mail, and you practically pee your pants. You know, you are an adult. As a matter of fact, you're practically middle-aged. All right, let me check this out. Education, right?
Yes.
Well, she must have a PhD.
Nope, two PhDs.
One in physics.
And she should be an opera singer.
And 6 feet tall.
Oh, let's not go overboard. She's Chinese, after all. 5'9". And she should speak 5 languages.
Good.
You're right. It's kind of stupid, all these lies. I'm used to it.
The Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema is currently spotlighting new films produced by Ted Hope and James Shamus. I asked them to describe what a production company does. Here's James Shamus.
The work of a production company and of a producer is twofold. On the one hand, one grovels for money on behalf of film projects that one would like to make. And then once one gets the money, one mobilizes a small army of either unionized or non-unionized, fully exploitable young people to make that film. Most people think that's where the work of producing ends. But in fact, for us, that's kind of only about one-fourth of the way through. Because at that point, especially if you're independent producers, and I know that I've never really met a dependent producer before, at least one who would describe him or herself that way. But independent production is about keeping that activity outside of the purview of the studio system as long as possible. And so that what we try to do is we make the films, so to speak, below radar and then try to inject them into the distribution and marketing systems that Hollywood and the other international distribution entities can provide.
Well, let me ask you why you'd want to make movies outside of the studio system but then distribute it within the studio system.
Well, I would say this, that the people who know how to sell movies best, which are the people in Hollywood, are often the people who know how to make movies the worst. That is to say, the skills that it takes to get somebody to buy a can full of mashed peas are not the same skills that it takes to make a meal at a 4-star restaurant. And we respect those skills enormously, skills that we don't have the resources and many times the will to hone and to exercise. On the other hand, we know that there are audiences out there that are currently underserved by the apparatus, the machine that's out there in Hollywood, and that are best served by the good machine.
Now, it seems like there's really been an explosion of independent movies, and in a way, independent films have replaced so-called art films and foreign films. Has distribution of independent films changed to keep up with this explosion?
Yeah, not only has it changed, but it's actually, I think, creating an infrastructure and a system which will probably destroy the entire independent movement which created it. That is to say, I think independent filmmakers and filmmaking are becoming victims of their own success. You know, it used to be just maybe 6 years ago, you would make a nice little $1 million movie, you would cycle a bunch of prints around, spend a little money on advertising and a publicity tour. And if you grossed $2 million, you were opening champagne bottles. You were very happy, not only emotionally, but also economically. And then came a little company called Miramax and others who started finding that if they started acting like studios in a certain way, they could get what they would call crossover hits, things like Pulp Fiction. And suddenly these companies needed to pay the rent and to pay staffs that could support releases on 2,000 screens, for example, of a film like Pulp Fiction. And you do Pulp Fiction once, you know, on a Monday, and next week you have all the people who are there supporting Pulp Fiction, and what are they going to do next? They want another one. And suddenly those little $1 million movies that made $2 million are economically insignificant jokes and really have nothing to do with the system itself, which has been created precisely because of the success of independent films.
The companies, the distributors, just can't take the chances they used to. They look at the minimal box office now being usually around like $5 million that they want to get from one of these specialized films, and it makes the smaller movies unreleasable. It has transformed the way film festivals work too, in that those now become kind of the old art house theaters. It's the only place that you have a chance of seeing frequently the new American independent work or the new hit foreign film. They just don't show. And it's scary and sad.
Now, Good Machine worked on Ice Storm and Sense and Sensibility, two of Ang Lee's movies, and you've been working with Ang Lee basically throughout his career. So I'm wondering if you feel that you too have fallen victim in a way to this, you know, larger ambition type of movie, the bigger budget, the bigger distribution.
Well, we still very much balance the large films with the small films. And being a director-driven company, we're forced to grow when the directors grow. Aang's vision, you know, has changed quite a bit from the days of Wedding Banquet to now with Ride with the Devil. But the films that are showing currently at the Philadelphia Film Festival, for instance, are all first-time directors, movies that were made with budgets of under $1 million. And we have several of those still in development, you know, that we hope to find many more Ang Lees that will grow with.
Yes, but there's no reason to be defensive, Ted. I mean, it's really fun making big Hollywood movies. In fact, the system is changing quite dramatically as Hollywood itself understands the need to be able to identify different kinds of audiences and audiences that are more interested in more provocative fare. So the system itself is starting to eat its young, so to speak, and to bring them into the fold, and we're obviously following along. You know, it's not that we don't want to sell out. We would desperately love to sell out. Nobody has just offered to buy us.
James, you mentioned the problem of independent cinema becoming a victim of its own success, and you mentioned Pulp Fiction in that category. What about The Full Monty? Is that considered an independent film? It's certainly been very commercially successful, more so than anybody expected.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, I mean, these discussions which rage within the film community as to what is truly an independent movie. And these days, that discussion itself, I think, is a kind of a lure to get people involved in some kind of identification with independence. But I happen to find the topic wildly itself, just as on its own, wildly misleading, given the fact that The Full Monty was financed by a young independent filmmaker named Rupert Murdoch, and its wild success worldwide goes directly into his pockets. In other words, yeah, it's an independent film. These are young, emerging filmmakers trying to do something fun and new. They're coming from a corner of the world and a place in that world which is not particularly known for its cinematic dominance, that is to say Sheffield, England. And they've made a wonderful film that has played around the world. It has played around the world via a support system provided by Fox Films International and a subsidiary here in the United States called Fox Searchlight, with whom we actually have made a number of films too. And the people who run those companies love movies and love to make new and interesting kinds of movies that people love to see. And at the end of the day, Rupert Murdoch figures out what their bonus is at Christmas time based on the performance of those movies, just as he figures out everybody else's bonus in that empire.
Tell me a little bit about how distributing a film is different when the film is a very inexpensive film compared to when there's a lot more money behind it.
Well, usually for that type of movie, the main way that they market is through the critics' reviews, that they depend on what the New York Times, the L.A. Times, the major papers say, and that will determine how much money is then spent on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they used to claim that it had something to do with something they called word of mouth. The problem is that you now book a film into a theater for its opening night on Friday night, and by Saturday morning, the theater owners pretty much know whether or not they're going to want to throw that movie out the next week for the next big indie hit to come along. They're not going to give it much of a chance, much time to grow through the old-fashioned way of people talking to each other about what they thought about the film. They're going to look at the opening day grosses, just as they do with Hollywood films, to determine how the marketing has worked and how it's drawn people into the theater. And they're going to believe that that's how independent films should be bought and sold in the marketplace. So word of mouth these days, unless people are talking on their cell phones during the movie, is not going to help an independent film that much.
Back when October Films got started, I think their second release was Mike Leigh's Life is Sweet, which, if I recall correctly, it's in its eighth week, it did more business than in its previous weeks. Those days are long gone, and it's sad and unfortunate, because how do you make a film such as A Life is Sweet or More Personal Vision reach a wide audience and have that audience respond? You depend on word of mouth, and then, as James has so articulately put it, doesn't exist anymore.
See, Ted, you were agreeing with me.
Now, there's something called platforming, which is a strategy where you release a new film to a small number of theaters in select cities, and then you slowly open the film in more cities. What's the strategy behind that? Is that to get more word of mouth in the new cities?
Yeah, platforming, which is still in use, although in a rather accelerated, hyped-up, speeded-up way these days than it used to be, was a very low-cost way to distribute films city by city, market by market, where you would build a consensus among media opinion makers in major markets like New York and Los Angeles, and then you would bring the film, you'd take the print from one city and just move it over to another city, and you would put out an ad there and you would release it in that city. And you would avoid having to buy things like advertising on network television or national cable television or national radio. And you would avoid having to buy advertising spreads in national print media. So you could try to do a very low-cost, labor-intensive, city-by-city approach to the release. So you have a film, for example, a decade ago, Howard's End, that was released by the management team that now runs Sony Pictures Classics. And they had that film in release for well over a year. And it would just go, at any given time, it would be on maybe 20, 30, 40 screens around the country. But those screens would change slowly. Nowadays, you could never get a foothold into one of those smaller markets unless you can prove to the theater owners that you're supporting the release of that film in that market within a very aggressive marketing campaign. So the bar has been raised, and the price of admission to the marketplace is now so high that you begin, even for films like Howard's End, you begin to have to act like the studios. That is to say, buy your opening weekend by cramming the advertising down the throats of your target audience and hoping they'll respond to that advertising.
Do you ever feel like your budgets end up being out of whack because of the necessities of the marketplace, where you know, you've kept the budget really low for the filmmaking and it really came in very inexpensively, and then you have to blow a lot of money just getting it into the theaters?
Well, let me give you one example. We recently made a movie for a very small budget, mm-hmm. and while the film was being released, a music video tying in one of the songs that was used in the soundtrack was produced for approximately 1/4 the budget of the entire movie.
Right.
So 4 music videos would have added up to more than the cost of the entire film.
What was the film?
Am I allowed to say, Ted?
Yeah, you can say.
It was called what was it called?
She's the One.
Oh, She's the One. Eddie Burns' film, starring Jennifer Aniston.
My guests are James Shamus and Ted Hope, founders of the production company Good Machine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ted Hope and James Shamus, founders of the independent movie production company Good Machine. I think Harvey Keitel's success in several independent films like Bad Lieutenant and Reservoir Dogs, The Piano, certainly Pulp Fiction, has made a lot of actors realize that it's sometimes really worth the risk to be in a movie by an unknown or not well-known director, because sometimes those films make it big. Have you found that there are a lot of bigger stars who maybe aren't getting as many big roles at the moment who are anxious to be in the hot new independent film, although they don't necessarily know which film will be the hot film. Is that door more open now than it used to be?
The entire business of trading in stardom and stars has changed totally vis-a-vis the independent world in the past 3 years. And I do credit Pulp Fiction in particular and Bruce Willis's role in Pulp Fiction with that, because you had a situation before Pulp Fiction more or less in which you would independent producers like us would call the studios, and usually they'd have caller ID and be able to just block the call or call the agencies. But we would call up an agent, we'd say, we'd really love to have, you know, a big star in our movie. We think he'd be great. And just, you know, I'm sure they'd love, even stars like to act occasionally. And wouldn't this be wonderful? And the agents would always say the same thing, which is, I'd love to do this because I love your filmmaker and I love you guys and my actors, I'm sure, would love you too. But if anybody finds out that they're not taking $15 or $20 million to be in a movie, they'll never get their quote, which is their price, from the studios ever again. So if I ever let my actor take less another job than his highest paid previous gig, I will ruin his position in the marketplace. And this was a constant refrain to us for about 5 years. And then slowly certain careers, and also the career of Keanu Reeves, I know it's hard to remember, it's so long ago, but Keanu actually began his career by being in very low-budget independent films with directors like Gus Van Sant, and then going into big-budget Hollywood comedies like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And he would go back and forth. And no one had really been managed that way before. And people started to take notice. And by the time Bruce Willis showed up in Pulp Fiction for a mere $150,000, which sounds like a lot of money to me, but apparently it was chump change for him at the time, and survived that, in fact, thrived on that choice, suddenly producers like Ted and myself, who used to be just complete, you know, persona non grata at the agencies, are really doing a lot of business there. And it's great for the agents because even agents like movies, it turns out. And they really do like to get their clients into interesting stuff. So it's been a wonderful change. The problem, of course, is nowadays, as one or two independent films actually make a lot of money each year, suddenly Bruce Willis is on offer to our latest low-budget independent film. But at the same time, they say, but come on, let's get $15 million. Let's get $20 million for him. I mean, you know, you'll make it back.
That changing tide is also, I think, harmed some of the unique qualities of independent specialized film. There's often a tendency of what I call casting for failure, where these former stars are now, you know, eager to be in your independent film, but they're not fresh. What people like to see in a specialized film is a discovery, something that they haven't experienced before. And frequently you see these, you know, video names or stars of yesteryear populating all of these, you know, cool new indie films, and it ends up being kind of tired formula.
Wait, I think what you're saying is you don't want your independent films to be used like the Love Boat. It's a sanctuary for washed-up stars.
it happens quite a bit now. Sometimes that's really exciting, you know, that, you know, certainly who, you know, Tarantino's a genius for it, you know.
But Tarantino takes actors who he really loves, who are sometimes pretty obscure, like Robert Forster or Lawrence Tierney, and revives their career through this real passion for them, not because he just got a good buy or something.
Certainly.
James, you've said that you think that it's best now to make movies outside of the Hollywood system, to make them independently where you have more creative control, but then to distribute the films within the Hollywood system because that's the system that really knows how to sell movies. I believe that you have a distribution deal now with 20th Century Fox. Is that right?
Yeah, we have what's known as a first look deal with all the different divisions at Fox, which obligates us to show them material that we're interested in making before we show it to anybody else. And for that right, they pay an overhead contribution to us. And let me go ahead and completely contradict what I said earlier. We found that working within the Hollywood system with the right people can be just as much fun and just as creative as working outside it with either the right or the wrong people. In other words, it's really it's not so much the amount of money on the check that makes the difference. It's who's signing the check. And if you find the right people, you're in pretty good shape. If everyone knows what the movie is that you want to make and we're all in agreement when we go forward that that's the movie we want to make.
I would say unequivocally that the films that we've made in the studio system have been enhanced by making it in that fashion.
Well, look at Aang's films in particular. I have to say that if you take a look at The Wedding Banquet, which we made completely independently, we, in writing and producing that film and marketing it, we understood more than implicitly that we were really remaking a classic Hollywood film. This was a screwball comedy, 40s-style type of film, except that it happened to be Chinese and gay. But in its essence, it's really classic Hollywood cinema. As Aang's career has progressed or evolved or just simply chronologically unfolded, and we have come closer and closer to the belly of the beast of the studio system to where now we really make movies very much within that system, his movies, oddly enough, have become weirdly more avant-garde. And I think The Ice Storm, for example, this is a studio film with major stars in it, and yet the last 10 minutes of screen time of that film are almost completely silent. There's literally one sentence spoken in the last 10 minutes of that movie. That's a studio film.
My guests are James Shamus and Ted Hope, founders of the production company Good Machine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ted Hope and James Shamus, founder of the independent movie production company Good Machine. You're both on the set now in Kansas City shooting, working with Ang Lee on his new movie, which is being shot now. And this is a Civil War movie, yes?
It's a film that takes place during the Civil War, but on its western frontier, so that unlike other Civil War movies where you have lots of reenactors charging across fields and boringly pretending they're killed when something blows up next to them, this is a film that really goes to the heart, we think, of a kind of suppressed history of the American Civil War, which was where it was really neighbor against neighbor.
It's the border war between Missouri and Kansas.
And the movie's called Ride with the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
So is part of your job on the set here to keep the costs contained? I mean, do you have to say something like, this scene is being shot too many times, it's going over budget, and you've got to just finish it on the next take? Do you have to be the bad guys?
You certainly sometimes have to pull the plug. The nature of producing is the balance, though, between the financial aspects and the creative aspects. We do, you know, run what's known as hot costs every day. We know what each day has cost us and how it's varied from our initial predictions. And that does influence what you have to shoot, because at a certain point maybe you've spent too much. But the role of the producer is to try to keep that all in line. So far, I think Aang has got everything that he's wanted.
Well, Aang is always surprised because when I write screenplays for him, as I did on Ice Storm and on this film, I'll be on set and I'll say, look, you guys have got to cut out the rest of the scene. We don't really need it, or, you know, just cover it in a master shot. Let's move on to the next thing. And Aang turns to me and goes, but you wrote it. Don't you want to see it on the screen? I said, when I was writing it, I was a writer, but now I'm a producer. Get moving, pal. So, you know, he's always a little shocked at how brutal I'll be in terms of delivering the movie on budget and within the framework of that the production has provided.
So, how do you as a producer justify telling him to cut a scene that you wrote and that you like?
Well, you know, what you try to do is never say no. You just simply provide options. So this has always been Ted's mantra, so that if you're in the midst of shooting a scene that looks like it's going to run over or get too expensive, you don't say no. You simply say, well, you can do that, but then you won't be able to do X, Y, or Z. Frankly, it's pretty ludicrous way of saying no, but it sounds different than saying no.
One of the, I think, most successful films, maybe surprise successes, that Good Machine produced was Brothers McMullen. And I'm wondering at what point you knew that this was going to be a big hit, and if there was anything that you think you did to help make it a hit, or what it just kind of struck a nerve and caught on.
I knew it was going to be a big hit the minute Ted told me it would be a big hit. essentially, that was a film that, in its over two-hour version, Eddie had shown to every distribution company and studio in North America, and they had passed on it. And Ted sat with Eddie in the editing room after he had shot the footage and really walked through what it would be and what it would take to get Eddie to make a film that would embody his vision and the fun of that vision and still be sellable in the marketplace. And so Ted really spent a good month and a half, I guess, on the night shift, which was the free shift in the editing room, sitting with Eddie and listening to him and kind of helping him walk through the final stages to get that film to marketplace. And it was really something of a thrill to be at the Sundance Film Festival that year with a film like The Brothers McMullen on the one hand, and on the other hand, a film that we had spent 4.5 years trying to finance, a film called Safe by a filmmaker named Todd Haynes.
I have to say, I think that's a great film.
Yeah, we're sublimely proud to have been even peripherally associated with that movie. And to have both of those films, on the one hand, a movie that really expressed the freshness and energy and excitement of independent cinema the way Eddie's film did, and on the other hand, a film that really expressed a young artist coming into consummate mastery of the craft of independent filmmaking, like Todd's film, that was pretty much of a high.
Well, I want to congratulate you both on your award from the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema, and thank you very much for talking with us about movies.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
James Seamus and Ted Hope are the founders of the production company Good Machine, which is based in New York. Their new movies are being spotlighted at the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema, which continues through May 10th. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Alan Tu. Research assistance from Sarah Scherr. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the dime. His sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve his belly ache. I said, said, Doctor, to relieve his belly ache. Now let me get this straight. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you called your doctor, woke him up. Said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said,
for tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.